Hello there and welcome to The Monarchy with me, Samson Sees, here on Press TV. We're back again to give you the alternative stories that concern Britain. Just before we continue with today's hot topics, we'll quickly have an update on the latest UK news headlines. Indeed, you can find out more information about these news items on our website at presstv.ir/Britain.
The British Foreign Office has reacted positively to the announcement of the results of Iran's 11th presidential elections, but repeated its own policy of falsifying the situation on the ground. The language used in the Foreign and Commonwealth spokesperson's statement shows the UK government does not want to acknowledge the deep-rooted democracy present within the Iranian establishment. A major new study warns that the UK justice system is losing the fight against modern slavery by prosecuting victims of human trafficking rather than the criminal chieftains. The findings of the study commissioned by the Anti-Trafficking Monitoring Group, ATMG, suggest that a unified law on the crime is required to make it easier to prosecute. And it comes at a time when the number of trafficking victims identified is soaring and criminal convictions for the offence have plummeted. Britain's Peace Index has fallen down among other nations, being ranked 44th in this year's Global Peace Index, a fall of 3 places compared with the previous year. The annual report by the Institute for Economics and Peace considered 22 indicators, including homicide rates, political instability, and terrorist activity among 162 countries across the world. British Prime Minister David Cameron has been warned not to even think about intervening in Syria militarily at a time when his coalition government is cutting thousands of army jobs. A group of Conservative MPs and retired officers warned the Prime Minister that his plan to arm foreign-backed terror groups fighting the Syrian government would be the first step down a path that could lead to another British military invasion of the Middle East region. Britain's Treasury has signalled major cuts to the Scottish budget for the 2015-16 financial year after 6 government departments agreed to a combined reduction of 8% in their budgets. The departments, which agreed on new spending cuts, include the Home Office, Department for Environment, Food and Rural Affairs, and the Department for Culture, Media and Sport, which mostly cover areas devolved to Scotland. The other 3 departments are the Scotland Office, Wales Office and the Law Officers Department. The actual amount of cuts to each department and how they could impact Scotland is still not clear, as the Treasury has delayed giving details until the spending review is unveiled. New figures released by the Department for Work and Pensions, DWP, have revealed that at least 1 in 6 children in Britain lives in relative poverty. In 2011 to 2012, 2.3 million or 17% of UK children were recorded as living in homes with substantially lower than average income. The figure rises to 3.5 million or 27% when housing costs are deducted from incomes. But children's campaigners say the figure is much higher and that 300,000 more children live in poverty compared to the previous year.
Now, if you watched our program last week, we covered an emerging talk of republicanism in Australia. So who is spreading the idea? Earlier this month, Australia's Deputy Prime Minister Wayne Swan called for an end to the British Queen as Australia's head of state. He actually brought this message across during Her Majesty's 60th anniversary of the coronation. Bear in mind, there hasn't been a referendum on Australian independence from the monarch since 1999. So could new figures be swung around? It was pretty close last time. 55% of Australians were in favour of Elizabeth II remaining as their monarch, while 45% wanted change. So that was 1999. In 2009, a survey found the tables turning, with 59% wanting a republic and only 33% wanting to keep Elizabeth II in power. Of course, the Queen's appointed Governor-General, Quinton Brice, in Australia, does hold several powers herself. She has the right to select a Prime Minister if there was a hung parliament. She can even dismiss a Premier if there's a loss of confidence of lawmakers. But hang on a sec, aren't these the same sort of powers Queen Elizabeth has in the UK? It's time to find out more, don't you think?
In the wake of the 60th anniversary of the coronation of Britain's Queen Elizabeth II, some senior lawmakers in Australia are calling for the government to declare itself a republic and break away from its colonial British heritage. Not many nations around the world are aware of the nature of Queen Elizabeth II's influence on the Australian constitution, a monarch who lives 10,000 miles away. Elizabeth, now 87 years old, is the official head of state and sovereign leader of 16 nations, including Australia, New Zealand, Jamaica, and Canada. Australia currently operates as a constitutional monarchy. The Queen's influence in Australia is not entirely ceremonial either. As a matter of fact, no Australian can decide about the fate of his or her country when it comes to foreign affairs, defence-related matters, and even the head of state. Such power is solely granted to the British Queen, who is represented by the Governor. The Governor-General of the country, whom she appoints, is the Commander-in-Chief of the military, has the power to pick ambassadors, ministers and judges, and also must approve of all laws passed by the Canberra Parliament. The Governor-General, currently Quinton Brice, the first ever female to hold the post, also can dissolve both the House of Representatives and the Senate. For some Australians, the monarchy's continuing involvement in politics is a stain on their national pride. Royalists, on the other hand, say the enduring constitutional monarchy is a tribute to the nation's historical legacy. Australia, once a British colony like the US, never fought for independence. Rather, the so-called Commonwealth of Australia was formed in 1901 through an accord between London and colonies composed of mainly European settlers that formed the basis of today's federation of six states and two territories. The agreement left intact the British monarch as the head of state, giving the Queen's representative, known as the Governor-General, the right to appoint a Prime Minister in the event of a hung parliament and to dismiss one that had lost the confidence of lawmakers. For decades after the deal, Australians would continue to sing the UK's national anthem and refer to their currency as the Australian pound. Britain's influence lives on in the country's Westminster-style parliament, while some banknotes and coins still sport Queen Elizabeth's image. And while the national flag depicts the clearly visible constellation of the Southern Cross against Australia's night sky, the Union Jack inhabits the top left corner, leading some to cynically refer to the ensign as Britain at night. The fact that the Australian head of state has never been an Australian citizen living on the other side of the globe has always fueled republicanism in Australia. Republicans argue that the monarch resides in the United Kingdom for the majority of the year. This differs ethnic demographics in modern Australia to its mostly British past, and laws of succession to the throne are contradictory to the Australian Constitution. Republicanism is the view of Australia's ruling Labour Party and a significant amount of the opposition Liberal Party. The Australian Greens strongly support a move towards a republic. In the Senate, the Greens have proposed a legislation to hold a plebiscite on the republic at the next federal election. Meanwhile, the Australian Democrats, formerly Australia's third party, strongly support a move towards a republic through a system of an elected head of state through popular voting.
We are mindful of the grief you bear.
A modern democracy that one of our citizens or any one of our citizens can't aspire to be our head of state. And how can it be that the sole qualification to be the head of state is inherited privilege?
There has been a referendum in Australia about the structure of the establishment. The Australian Republic referendum, held on the 6th of November 1999, was a two-question referendum to amend the Constitution of Australia. The first question asked whether Australia should become a republic with a president appointed by Parliament following a bipartisan appointment model, which had been approved by a half-elected, half-appointed constitutional convention held in Canberra in February 1998. The second question, generally deemed to be far less important politically, asked whether Australia should alter the constitution to insert a preamble. For some years, opinion polls had suggested that a majority of the electorate favoured a republic. Nonetheless, the republic referendum was comfortably defeated due to sustained opposition from monarchist groups and to division among Republicans on the method proposed for selection of the president. There have been no more official surveys in this regard. However, the latest poll suggests a growing support for a republic.
We owe much to the delightful Balinese.
An opinion poll held in November 2008 that separated the questions found support for a republic at 50%, with 28% opposed. In October 2009, another poll by UMR found 59% support a republic and 33% opposition. A survey of 1,000 readers of the Sun Herald and the Sydney Morning Herald, published in the Sydney Morning Herald on the 21st of November 2010, found 68% of respondents were in favour of Australia becoming a republic, while 25% said it should not. More than half of the respondents, 56%, said Australia should become a republic as soon as possible, while 31% said it should happen after the Queen dies.
I obviously am a Republican. I believe that this nation should be a republic. I also believe that this nation has got a deep affection for Queen Elizabeth. What I would like to see as Prime Minister is that we work our way through to an agreement on a model for the republic, but I think the appropriate time for this nation to move to being a republic is when we see the monarch change. Obviously, I'm hoping for Queen Elizabeth that she lives a long and happy life, and having watched her mother, I think there's every chance that she will.
A survey in 2011 suggested that 10 years from now, Islam will become the dominant religion in Britain for the first time. But at the moment, Muslims in Britain have become victims of a series of racist attacks by followers of far-right groups such as the British National Party and the English Defence League. If you read last month, around 12 mosques in the UK were attacked, including one that was hit by three petrol bombs up in Grimsby, along with 200 Islamophobic incidents occurring in total. These sorts of hate crimes have soared ever since British soldier Lee Rigby was knifed to death in southeast London on May the 22nd.
To have a more in-depth look at the incident, Mr. Raza Kazim of the Islamic Human Rights Centre has joined us. Raza drew us a bigger picture of the Woolwich incident.
I think one of the things that we need to understand within this whole thing that is actually going on is if we step back from the kind of horrific attack that actually took place and analyse what actually happened, then something else starts to come to light. with regards to what actually happened. We had the situation where the person was on camera being recorded, being interviewed by someone who recorded what he was saying on the mobile phone. That person had just killed a British soldier. And he was saying that we're doing this, and I paraphrase, we're doing this because this is being done to Muslim men and women across the world. And he did not go on a killing spree of the people that were passing by. We also see a woman going right past him as he was talking with the meat cleaver still in his hand, and he did not attack her. The next time that we see that these people are attacking is when the police arrived. So if we analyze what actually happened, what we're seeing is that two groups of people were attacked. One was the soldier and the other one was the police officer. And we need to recognize that while this action has been going on, what is behind this? One of the things that we hear is that there has been contact with MI5. There's also been the issue that one of those people had evidence that was obtained by from one of them had been done via torture, which the British authorities had actually used. So there are issues and things that are going on behind this, and we need to look at what's actually being said. One of the things that the person says, and this is something that the British establishment is actually in denial about, which is the fact that they are saying that this is nothing to do with foreign policy. We saw with 7/7 that the prime driver was what the actual attackers were saying was that it was to do with foreign policy. This person is saying that it's to do with foreign policy. He is only targeting the security apparatus of the British state. He has not targeted everyone else that has been walking around. So there needs to be that understanding of what's actually happened in this particular case.
Almost all British Muslims decried the murder. However, there was a clear agenda in the mainstream media to use such condemnations to even tar more of the Muslim community. I asked Mr. Kazim to evaluate how the media reflected the whole truth.
I think one of the things that we need to understand about what happened with regards to the Woolwich incident is the kind of media attention that was actually given to it. Often Muslims are being asked to come onto the media, and when they're asked to come onto the media, it's because they're asked to condemn what actually happened. And this is seen as something that is newsworthy. And that in itself is a problem, because it has a subtext that behind the question that what one is actually asking is that you are such barbarians, the fact that you are condemning this is in itself newsworthy. And we need to recognize the narrative that the media is pumping out by asking that question. We need to understand that there was, remind people that 2 weeks before that incident, a 70-year-old man, Muslim man, was knifed to death in similar circumstances, going to prayers. And nothing was reported in the national media with regards to this. So one of the things that we immediately need to think about is what is the hypocrisy surrounding how these things and these incidents are actually reported, and why was it that there was a continual stream of stuff that were being reported about in this way, and Muslims being actually paraded to be able to condemn this particular incident.
Those who are following the story in the media, and specifically the press, have heard a lot about fanatics like Anjum Chowdhury being represented as the voice of British Muslims, while the rational voices from this community are practically boycotted. I asked Raza about his take on this issue.
Lens and that same spotlight is not actually being targeted at, for example, Anjum Chowdhury. He's been allowed to come onto the mainstream media, and he's allowed to go around protesting and beating people and his crowd beating people up and the police there are only two or three police officers managing that demonstrations. This is unprecedented in terms of the way the policing should work, considering Anjum Chowdhury ran an organization which was a proscribed terrorist organization. And on the other hand, on the other side, if you like, of the spectrum of hate, on the other side, as it were, we also have Anjum Chowdhury is being used as a figure of hate, so that every time the Muslim community needs to be represented, he is the one that's peddled out by the media, rather than looking at the voices and articulate voices that exist in the Muslim community to deal with this particular, this or any other issue. So the British government and the British media is actually trying to encourage this direction, where they're trying to make sure that these kind of people are brought out into the mainstream.
Shortly after the incident, David Cameron called a COPRA meeting. How threatening was such an incident for the national security?
We saw that David Cameron actually came back to attend a COBRA meeting, and one wonders at why this was done, because if you actually analyse the incident, we recognise that the person who had just killed a serving British soldier on the streets of London did not then proceed to kill and terrorise everyone else that was in the vicinity. The next time they attacked was that attack took place when the police arrived, and they attacked the police, which is again part of the British security apparatus. Now, the fact that the British Prime Minister David Cameron actually came back to attend this meeting is again sending those signals out to people that this is somehow a huge terrorist incident, and this is some kind of a terrorist threat to all sorts of people. And it is about the continual kind of argument, kind of analysis that is being put forward by successive British governments, which is going to target the Muslims, which is going to target different aspects of the Muslim community.
While the official figures about the Islamophobic incidents since the Woolwich attack are surrounding 200, many Muslims argue that the real figures are much higher.
Some people have said, when they talk about, okay, let's report it, people become sceptical about what the result will be as from that. One of the organizations, Telmama, has started to, has been recording for some time statistics, and has said that only 200 incidents or whatever have taken place in such and such a time period. And it sounds and it's, it seems ridiculous that when people have reported about 800 incidents since the Woolwich incident, for example, of hatred, of abuse, etc., that have been targeting the Muslim community, that that Telmama is talking about using a methodology of collection of these statistics, which has found to be significantly flawed. And we have done a pilot study in which, and this is available, that getting the message, the recurrence of hate crimes in the UK. And what we found when we took a sample of just over 300 people is that 13.9% of them had been subject to physical abuse. I'm not going to quote the other statistics. 13.9% of those people had been subject to physical abuse. Now, there are 3.5 million people, Muslim people in the UK. Just think about the thousands, hundreds of thousands that the percentages actually will indicate have been targeted potentially in this way. Now, the statistics, the 13.9%, because it's only a pilot project, can be slightly out. But what the Telmama is actually quoting in terms of what's happened over the past months and so on is just problematic. It's just not right. And we need to think about what is actually going on with Telmama. We've seen that Telmama has someone from the Community Security Trust, the CST, a Zionist organization, as a member of its board. And we need to keep in mind what people from the Zionist community are going to try to do to make out that the problem within the community, Muslim community, are being targeted in different ways, whether it's from the authorities or whether it's from the general public, etc., is not a huge problem. And collecting statistics in this way is a problematic issue in the way that Telmama has actually gone about it. So even this pilot project from the Islamic Human Rights Commission has shown that has discredited what Telmama is actually saying.
Well, that's all we have time for this week, unfortunately. But if you wish to talk to us about anything to do with Britain, do not hesitate to comment on our Facebook wall. We go by the name of UK Desk Press TV. Or you could simply send us your emails via britain@presstv.ir. As always, we look forward to hearing about your ideas and opinions. So don't forget to watch our next episode. You've been watching The Monarchy, and The Monarchy has been watching Britain. Keep well. Take care. Bye-bye.
Riley, Pot Nazi, Parking Billy, goodbye to the crown.